Welcome to Violin Cello Podcast, Episode 8. We have a great episode planned for you. It has been a long time. I tried to look at when we dropped our last episode, and maybe I should not even say because it just makes it sound like we don't care. But it's been a few months. We've had very, very busy summers, and we will get into that. Then we will get into a little bit about both of us are teaching right now, like most musicians do to make a living. Really, for thousands of years, that's how musicians have made a living. So we're in a time-honored tradition. First, before we even get into that, I have just kind of a random fun thing that I wanted to get into, and I wanted to get a live reaction from David on this because I just pulled up the metrics for our podcast, and I was wondering if anybody had ever listened to this podcast. And I mean anybody, because I never even, my family does not know about this podcast. Like this is like top secret stuff, you know? And I've never really told any, I think one of my cousins I happened to tell randomly. You know, I was bored and I was like, "Oh yeah, I have a podcast." They're like, "Really? Whoa, cool." And that was pretty much it. So, do you have any guesses, David? How many people have downloaded the podcast?
10.
10. It's a good guess. It's a very good guess. This number might blow you away then. We have 487 downloads.
Wow.
And 27 in the last 30 days. And none of those are, by the way, none of those are me. I try to listen once on Spotify just to like make sure it's there, sort of thing. Here's the really cool thing. So I wanted to give a shout out here. We've had some downloads in Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam. It
Wow.
literally breaks down where they're from, which is kind of, you know, it's 2025, there's no privacy anymore. We have a download from Taiwan. But I might say, like, I happen to know that this district that it says is where the airport is. So it's probably just someone in the airport that was there. I'm picturing some guy that's been there for a week, you know, and maybe he's just lost, and finally he's going through every podcast in the world, and that may have been accidental, I'm not sure. And in the US, Nashville, Phoenix, great places. I've vacationed to both of those as a kid. So that's pretty cool. You know, people will find you if you produce a great product.
Indeed.
Okay, so let's get on to our summer stuff. How was your summer?
Oh, it was great. It was maybe the busiest summer of my life. Many, what, 18 concerts, probably 16 programs, maybe 15. So a
Wow.
lot of notes to play and a lot of notes to study, more importantly. How about you?
Well, yeah, tell us more. Like, where were you? Where were these performances? And
Oh,
you know, one place or you
it
traveled
was
around?
well, I guess those 18 were all in Breckenridge at the NRO. All orchestra, one concerto. Principal for half, assistant for the other half. So a lot of working on leading skills, which was a very much an added bonus. Something that I feel is almost like learning a new instrument. I think it can be very illuminating to be be put in a position like that where you have to lead. And if you don't, there can be musical consequences. So that was really good for my brain. Playing a concerto was really good for my brain and my working on my nerves. Absolutely.
Which concerto?
Brahms Double, which was a lot of work and a lot of fun, a lot of reward. Also very unique in the sense that, I mean, of course, I try to think of every piece as chamber music, but this really is chamber music. I mean, it's a large scale piece, but in a way, it's just large scale chamber music with the orchestra, but also with a fellow soloist and having to coordinate things. That's absolutely an added level of difficulty for that piece, but it was just wonderful and so good for development, having to not just learn my part and then, okay, play it with the orchestra, but learn my part and then put it together with another soloist where a lot of our lines work together in different ways, such that we really need to talk them through. Just like chamber music. So that was fantastic. But
Nice,
absolutely a
congrats.
lot of studying.
Yeah,
Oh,
congrats.
thanks.
That's amazing. Yeah.
You also had a very busy summer.
I mean, kind of the usual, for us musicians,
A
but
lot of traveling.
I almost forget now. We're recording this on September 3rd, and like summer seems like where was I? I was at Dairy Queen last night there. Do you have the pumpkin pie blizzard out? Like fall is here. So it's like summer's a distant memory. But I spent most of the summer in Philadelphia at the Philadelphia International Music Festival. And I did some admin there. And then I was a chamber music coach, which I found to be extremely rewarding. These kids are really inspiring. Like everyone I taught was just great attitudes, which is honestly, we'll get more into teaching, but what teachers want, number one, is a great attitude, more than even ability, more than anything else. So, yeah, these were great kids. And there were a couple sessions. This second session, yeah, was a lot bigger. So that was a lot of my June and July.
What were some of the pieces that you were coaching?
Oh boy. I coached Mendelssohn Octet, I remember that.
Oh, fantastic. Oh,
Yeah,
wow.
that was fantastic, yeah.
Wow.
It's great. There's some boy.
Well, I mean, talk about the
I'm on the
inspiration of
spot.
you.
No, I mean it's coming back now. I just didn't think about that. There was a Telemann piece that was really nice. Telemann wrote some great string chamber music. Really good stuff. But yeah.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, talk about the inspiration of youth being that Mendelssohn was 16 when he wrote that. I mean, what better place to be teaching and learning a masterpiece like that than at a summer music festival where you're, in the children's case, they're surrounded by other very talented, amazing people their age. I mean, that's just, can't beat that. The first time I played that piece, I was probably 16. It wasn't at a summer festival, but there's just so much to pick out of a piece like that. It's wonderful.
So much. It's one of the most remarkable things in the history of music, without a doubt. There's nothing like the Mendelssohn Octet. It's one of one.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, the instrumentation of the octet, but obviously it's the number one octet or whatever, but I mean, some people might debate that, I guess, but I don't know. It like defines chamber music in a way. Honestly, that's how I think of it. Like that is chamber music. So anyway, yeah, that was amazing. I didn't have air conditioner where I stayed, so it was a little austere. It was on a military campus, which is quite unique. Beautiful campus, all brick buildings, historic campus. Beautiful, but didn't get a lot of rest. So I've kind of been recovering for the last month. You know, my sleep and my privacy and all of that is being recovered now. But I'm feeling pretty good. Ready for a great fall semester here. So yeah, any other comment on your summer? I mean, Michael Stern is the one that kind of runs that, is that right? Or is he the artistic director there, or?
Yeah, and man, is he a genius. I just can't say enough good things about him. I think he's, I mean, first of all, the way that he speaks about music, particularly to audiences, he just instantly wins their hearts every single time. And he wins our hearts as well every single time. I think that he's just such a warm, knowledgeable, musical person, and he just exudes music, and it's there's nobody like him, and he was fantastic. And yeah, I don't know. I just, for me, it ended up being not even like I was practicing 5 hours a day to learn the parts as a principal, but more studying. Maybe not 5 hours a day studying, but definitely more than an hour a day, a couple hours every day studying these pieces. That's just kind of the approach that I've taken that I think, you know, it's interesting. I don't know how many other people feel that way, but that, you know, if I have to be principal or assistant principal for a piece that I particularly need to know how it goes well, much more than being able to play it super well. Although that's also important to being able to play the notes. Yeah, I could do better at
But
that.
it's sort of a given, you know.
Right. But
Yeah.
I didn't. The way that I kind of approach studying a new symphony or something is that I feel like I'm ready for the first rehearsal if I could play it without a conductor. That's kind of how I know, okay, I've studied this piece a sufficient amount to feel like I'm not going to be super nervous for the first rehearsal. So those are kind of my thoughts, and that led me to a lot of listening, both with the score and with the cello part. Probably 50-50. And so that way, you know, I feel comfortable. And then if there's things that I need to practice, then I'll take care of those things too. But those are my thoughts on being a principal in my very limited experience with that.
Yeah, I was thinking a bit, and you've played with me, so you know my tendencies. It doesn't take long to learn someone as a musician. But I am so used, I'm a second violinist in the quartet I play in. I am so used to following, but it's not just that. I think I prefer to not lead in some ways. So I was not that way if you would have grabbed me 10 years ago, because I was doing concertmaster things and I was much more used to leadership. So that just has me thinking. And our quartet, if I'm playing with the violist, I like he cues. He takes care of that. The cellist, she takes care of that. First violinist always takes care of it if I'm playing with. So I don't know. I'll have to like think about different styles of. I'm not sure exactly why, but I think it's out of respect more than anything. I want them to be able to play how they want to play, and like I'm fine just going along with if they have an opinion, you know. And I think that's probably a good place to start in chamber music. where you want to actually know someone else's opinion. Then if you don't like it, maybe you can say something, but I'm usually fine going along with, especially in my quartet, I'm the youngest and least experienced. So if they have ideas about style, and I always want to know what they're doing. So that's part of letting them cue, because they have something in mind. But as a section leader, you are, it's a little different in chamber music from that regard, because the person in the back of a section literally can't lead. It doesn't work that way. So it's that way as a principal, where you're queuing with other maybe principals, etc. So it give, in other words, orchestra is a lot more fun as a principal. And it's a lot more pressure too, but you get to be the ultimate chamber musician. And you do as a section player a little bit. You're listening to other sections, but it's a little different role.
I find that maybe the hardest chair to sit in is actually the second chair. I've kind of been thinking about that for a few years now. Having it may be a little bit different if like you are in the New York Philharmonic and you are second chair and you have a principal, but in the experiences I've had where I'm playing in different orchestras with different principals, I think that you have to be good at being something of a chameleon, it seems, to me. And I still struggle with that. It's a difficult chair to sit in, having to match your principal perfectly, or you have to make that attempt. I do a pretty bad job at it, but really following what they want and doing what they do, and while at the same time being careful not to overstep in any way, and just being that support system for your section and for your principal. I find that that's much harder than sitting principal, where I feel like, okay, I need to know this is how this piece goes cold. I need to lead a lot with my body, and I need to play the solos if there are any, which is the scariest part. But actually, if I'm principal, I often feel more comfortable. I feel like, okay, if I make a mistake, like it's okay. Whereas if I'm sitting in the second chair, like that could throw off the principal, and that would be just awful. So in a weird way, it feels like, perhaps it's also because I'm free to move a lot more in a demonstrative way, that I feel like that liberates me a little bit. I just feel comfortable. But sitting in the assistant role, or even in the third chair role, I find to be quite difficult, at least for me personally. But yeah, I totally agree with everything that you've said. And being a principal is like chamber music, especially if you have a good rapport with your other principal colleagues. But yeah, you certainly have to be on your toes, especially being thoughtful of the idea that, I move a lot when I sit principal. But then I ask people, and maybe they're just being kind or something, I don't know. I ask people, like, oh, am I moving too much? And they say, no, not at all. So I think it's one of those things that you can't really, it's difficult to do it too much. And I think people, it seems, appreciate when you show things as a principal. So it's, yeah, I mean, it's a very much a work in progress for me, but it's interesting to get that kind of experience. And I think everybody should get that kind of experience sitting as a principal in an orchestra. That she seems it taught me many new skills that I wouldn't have gotten just from playing in a section or playing chamber music.
Yeah, and also sitting next to a principal is also extremely valuable. It gives you a different perspective on, well, what the person next to you is going through. It's helpful to understand that as well. Yeah, on the whole movement stuff, I often do not I Yeah, I find that in my quartet, I always go back to my quartet because it's most of my playing. But in my quartet, I almost never move enough. And then as a principal, like you said, I'm like a different player. So your role does determine how you play, which is a very interesting. Like you said, you feel more free as a principal, and you also play that way. I mean, maybe that's not the quote unquote ideal. Maybe everyone should lock in with the principal player and play, but there, it's a little different as a principal. Your liberty and your freedom, and even your style of playing is just a little bit different. Because you, like you said, you have to be more demonstrative, and that bleeds into the actual playing a little bit. It can be too much sometimes. Like I have heard some really good orchestras, and I can pick out the concertmaster sound a little too much. But some of that is also because they sometimes have the best instrument. So, and instruments that carry way better, you know, if they're playing on a great Strat or something, or a Del Yaesu or something, it tends to cut through. But I miss being a principal. You have me be a little bit jealous now, because I absolutely love being concertmaster. And that the feeling of control, I think I'm a little bit of a control freak, but it's all you. And I really enjoy the freedom. And also the responsibility, I think, like you said, you have to be on your toes. That's a good thing artistically. And good, like that accountability is higher. And so it does force you to be at your best. And that is a good, it's a double-edged sword because you kind of have to prepare more and stuff too. But it's also more rewarding in a way because you've taken more ownership of the product. And many of us feed off responsibility, even if it's a love-hate thing. We still feed off of it, and I miss that aspect of orchestra playing for sure. Although to be fair, it's getting crazy now. You know this, but maybe the listeners do not. But I have not played in an orchestra in almost 6 years now, a single time. So I'm starting to lose. I'm like my And I always studied with chamber musicians. I never studied with orchestra players. But I'm like becoming like them. And it's I don't know if it's concerning or not, but I'm sort of specializing that way, and I guess it's just what happens naturally, because wherever you find success or whatever, you know, we all have a path. And it's interesting seeing that play out as you get older with other musicians, and you kind of see, like, how I believe kind of is like eventually you kind of find the way it was meant to be. Like, oh yeah, and then you can track, oh yeah, I could see how that person, that journey, I can see how they ended up where they ended up. And it's beautiful to watch. There really are different paths, even within something as narrow as playing the violin or cello. Yeah, let's talk a bit about teaching then. So we're both teaching, and you're kind of in a place now where you're trying to build a studio. Is that right?
I would, yes, that's what I would say. And I've certainly done a lot of, I wouldn't say I've had a lot of students for a lot of time, but I've taught a little bit here and there for many years now. And It's extremely rewarding, and but it's also a lot of work, and it's even more work trying to find students. I find that basically every time I meet a student, it's not through any doing of my own, but rather from some kind of recommendation or being on a list somewhere for a school, or things like that. And but I've also, as you have, I've also coached a fair bit of chamber music, and still do. And I have a few students, but actively recruiting, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, do you have any advice on the process of like getting students or like this is something that concerns a lot of almost all musicians. Is there are very few that only play and never teach, you know? So I was just curious.
I don't know, but I could point you in the direction of people that are very successful at finding, and they're also great teachers, but they're very successful at finding students. I think it's definitely, there's some luck involved, but also connections. It seems interesting to me how connections really are like 90% of it, at least in my experience so far, having reached out to about 20 public school teachers, elementary, middle, and high school. And I think I haven't heard from probably 16 of them. But the other four that I have heard from have been very warm, very positive and proactive. And they just seem like great people that want to help their students and seemingly also want to help me. They want to make those connections. And so it's been a big learning experience for me in the last like month, in this process. And so, yeah, I'm right in the thick of it now, and we'll have to check in again in probably another month or two and see what ends up happening. But as far as advice goes, I would say to, what I did was to reach out to as many people as possible. Mostly in this case, public school teachers, but also people could reach out to community music schools and things like that. Now, my thinking is that's maybe my second option, is teaching through an institution like that, because the pay basically cuts in half. But depending on the school, that could also be a wonderful thing, and they definitely have it. There's a big need, from what I can see all across Chicago. There seems to be a big need, maybe not necessarily for cello teachers, but certainly violin, piano, singing. There's a big need for people that want to teach, in those respects. And so I think there's a need out there, just putting yourself out there, basically.
Wow, I should move to Chicago. Sounds fantastic.
Yes, I keep seeing openings, really. Piano, voice, and violin all the time. I doubt it pays a fortune, but there's, as I said, a large need for people like that to come in and work with kids that really want to learn.
Yeah, I want to touch on discouragement a little bit because, well, it's a part of all of our lives as musicians. Anytime you want a job in an orchestra, there's a great chance you're not going to get the job right away. You're going to have to audition, you're going to be rejected. If you want a job in academia, you're probably going to face a lot of rejection unless you're absolute top soloist. And then, you know, anyone will probably bring you in as an adjunct or something. But, and when you're building a studio, you're going to face a lot of rejection. And one thing that can be hard that you might even, like, you're back in your hometown, I'm in my hometown, and I know people here from when I was a kid. And the brutal reality is, so you just have to prepare your mindset a little bit, because the brutal reality is that some people are just not going to help you that really should help you. And that can feel discouraging. I've even had, these people are still around, so I'm not going to name drop or anything, but there's some people that I knew from the past that just like disappeared. Like they're just not there. So when I need them to help me, or they're running programs and they're just not going to help. And like you said, you can send out 20, 30, 40 emails and just, I mean, you got four replies, which I think is amazing. That's incredible. Like you've done very well there.
Well, I
Now,
have to chime in and say three.
sometimes you get like zero or one or zero. You might send 40 emails and get zero, and that can feel really, but you have, like you said, you have to start somewhere and just don't, it's never, ever, ever personal to you. So never, ever, ever take it personally. Like these people are just, remember, they're just living their lives and they're busy, and who knows what's going on with their family, or they're taking care of parents or whatever's going on. And it's not personal. You just have to look at it like a numbers game. So kind of divorce from the whole, it's not about you. It's just a numbers game, like sales, basically. Like, so just send out the emails, get in contact, and it just takes one or two good connections to really give you a start.
Yeah, I was going to say three out of the four people I've had contact with in the past in one way, shape, or form, without going into specifics. So that's definitely helped. And then one person knew somebody that knew me, the fourth person, and also went to my same youth orchestra when she was a kid. So that's also a connection in a way. So you could say I've had connections to all four of those people. Wonderful people. But yeah,
Nice. So
it's really
I
great.
kind of want to, yeah, I kind of want to butt in and interrupt you, because in other words, if you graduate, you're 22 years old and you have a bachelor's in performance, any instrument, but say violin or cello performance, because that's what we are. And you've never done anything in your entire life. As a kid, you've never made connections. You've never played with others. Or if you have, you've been really, really bad to play with. And you're really annoying and you don't show up on time. And whatever else musicians do, you know, the ones we all have people that we can think of right off the top that are like this. You're not professional. You're really, really screwed. You're not going to find students because you're not going to have connections. Because you were never thoughtful as you go. So if you're a student right now, we all hear this. It's different later in life looking back than it is going through it. Because good teachers, like Professor Schleicher at U of I, like for example, he's an amazing teacher. I mean, he's now, I think he might be a Northwestern, but an amazing teacher. And he always was all about helping people in their career. And he was extremely helpful to me, because he would talk about, be thoughtful, even in this orchestra class, be thoughtful of how you interact with people. Your stand partner could be the one that hires you someday. And people kind of roll their eyes. But the fact of the matter is that that's actually correct. That's actually correct. Even if you think someone's not a good player or something, you might be surprised someday to see what position they're in and what position you're in. You really don't know. And it's not meaning to approach everything in a way that, oh, you're just going to try to be nice so that you can get something later. But it's a way of being thoughtful just in the way you approach your life with other people and how you deal with people. And if you're a type of person that people just want to be around and just want to be friends with and just want to be colleagues with, you will find more success in life.
Yeah, we had an excellent talk this summer about how, well, it was at the beginning of the summer, and the CEO was telling us how the gist of it was that this summer, you want to, all summer, in any interaction, you are defining your legacy for the summer, essentially, that, it doesn't matter if you're on stage, off stage, at one of the parties late at night, in the town, however you interact with people is how they're going to remember you. And so you keep in mind always, how do you want to be remembered by people? And so that was a very important point, and something I always try to keep in mind. And again, it happens anywhere. It can happen when you go out with your friends to Wendy's, which I did many a times with many different people. And those how you interact, people will remember that. And certainly heard many times about people that talk, oh, this person, said this, that was really rude, or this and that, and people talk and people remember. So I think that's very important. That you always keep that in mind. How do you want to be remembered? And that's equally as important as, if not more important, as how well you play or can teach or whatever it is musically that you do. It's also how are you to work with? How are you to be friends with? That's very important.
Yeah, a lot of yeah, we know how. I mean, the music world is just so small. So you'll never get, I'm not going to say you cannot recover from a mistake, because that's also not true. Obviously, the world is big, but it's shocking. And if you're of any age and you're a classical musician, you get it. Like, you understand. People talk. Like, this summer I heard so much tea from people. I mean, you just would hardly believe how much I heard about people. It's the entire summer about people in different situations at schools, and about prof also about professors. About, I mean, it's crazy how much gets out there. Even if you think you're nobody. If yeah, you might be known more than you think. Just like our podcast, David thought we had 10 views, but we actually had like 500. So I kind of want to talk about goals. And it's been big picture stuff, with the teaching thing today. And we might get into some nitty-gritty stuff later, but as a student, I believe you should always have, is it four goals at the same time? Always. You should have a goal for what you're going to get done today. You should have a goal for what you're going to get done this week. You should have a goal for this month, and you should have a goal for this year. So, as a teacher, I think it's the same thing, because we are the ones, especially when you're younger, you're not able to make goals. So your teacher kind of does that for you. So you have a goal for your student for even today, yes. I mean, but certainly for the week. Then you have a goal for, like, you're thinking, okay, in the next month, what do we want to get done? And then you're thinking for your student, in the next year, what can we get done? And it's not that these ever never shift, because life happens and paces change, they fluctuate. And then you can even have a 3-year vision or a 5-year vision if you're really, And that's not to say, oh, this is exactly how it's going to be in 3 years or anything like that. But you're just monitoring the long term for your student because they're not really doing that on their own. I think that's very important as a teacher to have the full picture. That takes a that's like a super upper level skill, and it takes experience working with different kids and understanding over the long term. The most rewarding thing as a teacher is that long term. I mean, it's fun to come in and coach for a week. That is fun. It's very rewarding. It's a fun experience. But then eventually these kids kind of drift, right? You're not, maybe there's one or two that keeps in touch. But these enduring relationships, I go back to the teachers I've had. I mean, I play with one of my teachers. So we have a 15-year relationship. And that's very, very precious. That might only happen with one or two students, but that's very precious. And it's something as a teacher, you start to become family after a long time. And if you study with someone, I studied with at U of I like 5 years of private lessons with the same teacher. I'm a big chunk of her life. You know, no matter what happens later or before, 5 years, that's a long, you know, your career, maybe it's 40 year, maybe 50 year, but that's a good portion of your career that she dedicated to me. And I never forget that. And I think that's the beautiful thing about teaching music. It's not like math or teaching science. I mean, not that you cannot have relationships with those teachers too, but we know the apprenticeship system of passing on music is unique and it's beautiful. So that's my spiel on setting goals and thinking long term. Any thoughts?
No, that's great. I was just thinking that I would add a fifth goal. And I was at first I was thinking for myself, but then I was thinking, actually no, for the student too. Like, what can I accomplish in the next like 5 minutes? You know, what do I want to get done right now? Like, I have 60 seconds. What do I need to do? Okay, I need to figure out how to start the opening of the Verdi Requiem as if it's not a downbeat, right? Or whatever, you know. I need to start the beginning of the Mendelssohn Scherzo, the pickup or the downbeat without an accent. I need to get comfortable doing that, you know, whatever it is. I need to get better at that because I do feel like I plan for the hour or the few hours, but there's probably a lot of time that gets lost in that hour that could be taken better advantage of. And same thing with students. You know, I find that often when I'm talking to students, a lot of my time is spent showing ways on how to practice things on their own. How would I practice this? I find that I do that a lot. But yeah, I think a good amount of time in a lesson can be spent with that thought in mind. Like, okay, like we have 2 minutes right here. How can we make this markedly better? I think that can be really helpful and also encouraging for the student. Like, oh, if I just practice for 2 minutes, I can actually become much better at this spot, and that'll really help me in all these other ways. So I think that's important too for the student's mentality as well.
Yeah, every once in a while, even with advanced students, I actually practice with them. I'm like, we're gonna spend 5 minutes, especially if something is bad 2 weeks in a row. Then I lose trust in how they're preparing or how they're practicing. If I know they're practicing, they're like, oh, I spent hours on this. I'm like, it's not better. Okay, so we have to practice it together, right? Even at the advanced level, we When we're on our own, we all are susceptible to wasting time and goofing off and not doing the thing we should do to practice most efficiently. But when your teacher's right there, it's like you have no choice. It's like, yeah, okay. And I literally like, okay, now stop, now go back, now do it in this rhythm. And like, okay, and I'll ask the questions that they need to be asking in their head. Okay, how did that go? Okay, how what do you need to do right now to make that better? And then a lot of times they'll be right, sometimes they'll have no idea. Then I'll tell them. Like, okay, this is what you need to do now. We actually practice. And like you said, there's immediate results. Because if you practice well, in 5 minutes, it's going to be way better. Every time, if you truly practice well, you're going to have improved a lot. So, yeah.
I always talk about musicians kind of being detectives, and that's very multifaceted. You know, if I do it in a sectional at a school, it's about, okay, what are some clues that the composer left behind in this music? And usually they're different markings, or dynamics, or things like that that we can take clues from, and that can help us play the piece in a new way. But also, I think that can be very helpful in this idea of practicing, where we have to figure out what makes this passage difficult for me. What is it about this passage? Have to figure it out. And what are different, innovative, efficient ways that I can break this passage down into its simplest form, and then build it back up. You know, what makes this passage hard? Okay, it's this one thing. How can I work on this in 20 different ways? And then put it together slowly, and then practice it in different ways. And so you're kind of like a detective and an architect in the same. Yeah, it's amazing. But that I think that's important in our practice, is to kind of think like detectives.
Absolutely. And the most important thing, literally the most important thing, I'm not exaggerating, but the most important thing for your success is how you practice. It is the most important thing. It's not your talent. It's not the amount of hours you do. It's how you practice. And yeah, I loved your Going back, I loved your like adding the goal of just a couple minutes. I absolutely love that. The other day, I had a performance last night actually, and I woke up yesterday morning, and I just was stressed, really stressed. I was like, man. And I figured out why I was stressed. It's because of this one passage that I had to play that night, and it was stressing me out like crazy. And I immediately went over, I woke up, I went over, I pulled my music, and I looked at that passage and I mentally practiced it. Right when I woke up, I was like, oh. Went over and I practiced it. I went through it again in my mind. And then I felt great. I was like, oh yeah, I can do this. I know it really well. And that was good. No problems. Did the performance, did it, the passage fine. The point is that 60 seconds to 2 minutes, it's almost always what you're afraid of. So that's how you can quickly determine what you need to practice for 1 minute. Okay, what am I gonna miss? What's in other words, what you're afraid of is what you might miss, because then you get afraid and then you missed it, right? We've all been there. That fear builds, or that stress, as we get to that spot, what you know what I mean, whatever spot that is, we get, and then we get scared, and then we miss it, or then we mess it up. So it's what are you afraid of? And that's a good place to start. Like, okay, that's what I need to practice right now. And for me, it was that page of like all chromatic scales for like a whole page. It was just brutal, and that Shostakovich. Trying to think if there's any, like, real quick, speaking of the 60 second, if there's one more teaching tidbit. We talked about practice, we talked about studio building, we talked about goal setting. If there's any other useful, I'm seeing a lot lately, like as a teacher, I have a love hate with Instagram. I had it, I was like addicted, and then I deleted it for a long time. Right now, I'm getting back into it. It definitely tends to go way too far. Like, it's just too much. It's designed to just pummel you and all the dopamine and all that jazz. But it is useful to see all these people teaching. I follow all these great violinists, and they're like teaching you things. It's very good to just keep your mind fresh in that way. If you're in a place where you're graduated and you're teaching now and you're no longer in a student environment where you're around all the time people talking about what you do, you gotta stay in the game. You've gotta stay like curious and like, oh wow, I want to try that out on my students, and wow, that's a great idea. How can I incorporate that? You want to keep getting ideas. Don't just teach the way you teach, because you're not going to be a good teacher. Trust me, you're not a good teacher. So you have to keep pulling, unless you've been doing it for 30 years. But you have to keep pulling different ideas from all over the place. Like, someone just had this idea with like doing different things, and this is a like pretty famous violinist, but bow like putting a pencil and bowing with different fingers. So you literally can't use these fingers, you have to use these. Or, you do it with the middle finger, you can't use the middle finger. That's just one example, but it really made me think, oh, yeah, I've done that, and but that's an interesting way to do that. And so stay fresh and stay current.
It's funny you say that. I actually sometimes I have students play like an open string. I'm like, okay, play it without the pinky, play without the ring finger, play without the middle finger, play without the index finger, play with only the index finger and the pinky, play with only the ring finger and the middle finger. Play. You understand? Play. And then we talk about how did you feel each time. What are the potential roles for each finger? I remember when I was a kid too, I had at least one, maybe two teachers have me play without the index finger. And, because sometimes the index finger has a tendency to try and be bossy to the other fingers into the hand. And then what ends up happening is portato. And so I found that that was an effective technique for helping me weed out portato, is to just take the index finger off. And so, yeah, that's what you reminded me of. But I think that's a great way to understand the different roles of each finger in the right hand.
Yeah, and these, and it might not be what you think too, with meaning like really, really great violinists actually do these exercises. Like, if you think it's stupid to, oh, why would I do that? It's not like real life. Why would I lift a finger off the bow? Like, we do this. I do this. When I practice, I do things like this. Augustine Haddelich does things like this. Like everyone does things like this, and have done things like that. It's all part of your journey, right? And apologies to Haddelich if he never does that, but we're always experimenting as musicians and trying to find different ways. Even great violinists, I'll hear say, "Oh, I just figured out something else. I just figured out some fingering." And the reason we figure things out is because we're experimenting with doing weird things. That's how you figure things out. So Do the experimental stuff like that that your teachers say, but it's also important to on your own to spend some time when you practice, and don't forget that to be curious about your instrument. Like, what would happen if I did this? And you can figure things out that are amazing, that maybe even some soloists would be like, wow, that's amazing, you figured that out. So, okay, I think we've nailed a lot in this episode, quite a bit. We finally caught back up. We were able to greet our friends in Vietnam and Taiwan and all over the US. It is amazing. 27 downloads in the last 30 days.
Very cool.
So, it goes back to that thing about sometimes people are watching and sometimes people do listen. Even when you think an orchestra or whatever, sometimes people do know, even if you think you're hiding pretty well. You're not playing in tune, someone might be listening. Yeah, any final words?
No, it's been great for me to think about these topics by talking about them. I think it's great to apply to our own teaching and practicing. So back to the drawing board for me.
All right, until next time. Ciao, ciao.